its reaction. This is a strategy that opossums use, but they are not the only animals to do so. In fact, accounts of the school shootings at Columbine and Virginia Tech demonstrate that students use the freeze response to deal with deadly predators. By holding still and playing dead, many students survived, even though they were only a few feet away from the killer. Instinctively, the students adopted ancient behaviors that work very effectively. Freezing your movement can often make you nearly invisible to others, a phenomenon every soldier and SWAT team operator learns. Thus, the freeze response has been passed from primitive man to modern man, and remains with us today as our first line of defense against a perceived threat or danger. In fact, you can still see this ancient limbic reaction to large felines in the theaters of Las Vegas, where big cats are part of the show. As the tiger or lion walks onto the stage, you can be sure that the people in the first row will not be making any unnecessary arm or hand gestures. They will be frozen in their seats. These people were not issued memos to remain still. They did so because the limbic brain has prepared the human species to behave that way in the face of danger for over 5 million years. In our modern society, the freeze response is employed more subtly in everyday life. You can observe it when people are caught bluffing or stealing, or sometimes when they are lying. When people feel threatened or exposed, they react just like our ancestors did 1 million years earlier. They freeze. Not only have we, as humans, learned to freeze in the face of observed or perceived danger, but others around us have learned to copy our behavior and freeze their behavior also, even without seeing the threat. This mimicry, or isopraxism, same movement, evolved because it was critical to communal survival, as well as social harmony, within the human species. The night the hands stopped moving. I was at my mother's house a few weeks ago watching television and eating ice cream with members of the family. It was late at night and someone rang the doorbell, something that is very unusual in her neighborhood. Suddenly, in the midst of eating, everyone's hands froze, adults and children alike, as if choreographed. It was amazing to see how we all reacted with hands flash frozen, at precisely the same moment. It turned out that the visitor was my sister, who had forgotten her keys. But of course, we didn't know it was her ringing the bell. It was a beautiful example of the hardwired communal response to perceived danger, and of the first limbic reaction, which is to freeze. Soldiers in combat react the same way. When the point man freezes, everyone freezes. Nothing needs to be said. This freezing action is sometimes termed the deer-in-the-headlights effect. When suddenly caught in a potentially dangerous circumstance, we immediately freeze before taking action. In our day-to-day life, this freeze response manifests innocently, such as when a person walking down the street stops suddenly, perhaps hitting himself on the forehead with the palm of his hand, before turning around and heading back to his apartment to turn off the stove. That momentary stop is enough for the brain to do some quick assessing, whether the threat comes in the form of a predator or of a thought remembered. Either way, the psyche must deal with a potentially dangerous situation. We not only freeze when confronted by physical and visual threats, but as in the example of the late-night doorbell, threats from things we hear, oral threats, can also alert the limbic system. For instance, when being chastised, most people hold very still. The same behavior is observed when an individual is being questioned about matters that he or she perceives could get them into trouble. The person will freeze in his chair as if in an ejector seat. A similar manifestation of the limbic freeze occurs during interviews when people hold their breath or their breathing becomes very shallow. Again, this is a very ancient response to a threat. It is not noticed by the interviewee, and yet it is quite observable to anyone watching for it. I have often had to tell an interviewee to relax and take a deep breath during the middle of an interview or deposition, as he was unaware of just how shallow his breathing had become. Consistent with the need to freeze when confronted by a threat, people being questioned about a crime will often fix their feet in a position of security, interlocked behind the chair legs, and hold that position for an inordinate period of time. When I see this type of behavior, it tells me something is wrong. This is a limbic response that needs to be further explored. The person may or may not be lying, since deceit cannot be directly discerned. But I can be assured from their nonverbal behavior that something is stressing them. Therefore, I will pursue the source of their discomfort through my questioning or interaction. Another way the limbic brain uses a modification of the freeze response is to attempt to protect us by diminishing our exposure. During surveillance of shoplifters, one of the things that stands out is how often thieves will try to hide their physical presence by restricting their motions or hunching over, as if trying to be invisible. Ironically, this makes them stand out even further, since it is such a deviation from normal shopping behavior. Most people walk around a store with their arms quite active, and their posture upright, rather than stooped. Psychologically, the shoplifters, or your son and daughter, as they try to surreptitiously swipe a cookie from the pantry, are trying to master their environment by attempting to hide in the open. Another way people try to hide in the open is by limiting their head exposure. This is done by raising the shoulders and lowering the head, the turtle effect. Picture a losing football team walking off the field after the game, and you get the idea. See Figure 4 on the PDF. Interestingly and sadly, abused children often manifest these freezing limbic behaviors. In the presence of an abusive parent or adult, their arms will go dormant at their sides, and they avoid eye contact as though that helps them not to be seen. In a way, they are hiding in the open, which is a tool of survival for these helpless kids. The flight response. One purpose of the freeze response is to avoid detection by dangerous predators or in dangerous situations. A second purpose is to give the threatened individual the opportunity to assess the situation and determine the best course of action to take. When the freeze response is not adequate to eliminate the danger, or is not the best course of action, that is, the threat is too close, the second limbic response is to get away by use of the flight response. Obviously, the goal of this choice is to escape the threat, or, at a minimum, to distance oneself from danger. Running, of course, is useful when it is practical, and as a survival mechanism, our brain directed our body to adopt this tactic judiciously over millennia in order to escape from danger. In our modern world, however, where we live in cities and not in the wild, it is difficult to run from threats. Therefore, we have adapted the flight response to meet our modern needs. The behaviors are not as obvious, but they serve the same purpose, to either block or distance ourselves from the physical presence of undesirable individuals or things. If you think back on the social interactions you've had in your life, you'll probably be able to recall some of the evasive actions you took to distance yourself from the unwanted attention of others. Just as a child turns away from undesirable food at the dinner table and shifts her feet toward the exit, an individual may turn away from someone she doesn't like, or to avoid conversations that threaten her. Blocking behaviors may manifest in the form of closing the eyes, rubbing the eyes, or placing the hands in front of the face. The person may also distance herself from someone by leaning away, placing objects, a purse, on her lap, or turning her feet toward the nearest exit. All of these behaviors are controlled by the limbic brain, and indicate that someone wants distance from one or more undesirable persons or any perceived threat in the environment. Again, we undertake these behaviors because, for millions of years, humans have withdrawn from things we didn't like or that could harm us. Therefore, to this day, we expedite our exit from a deplorable party, distance ourselves from a bad relationship, or lean away from those who are deemed undesirable, or even with whom we strongly disagree. See Figure 5 on the PDF. Just as a man may turn away from his date, an individual in negotiations may shift away from his counterpart if he hears an unattractive offer, or feels threatened as bargaining continues. Blocking behaviors may also be manifested. The business person may close or rub his eyes, or place his hands in front of his face, as Figure 6 on the PDF shows. He may lean away from the table, or the other person, and turn his feet away as well, sometimes in the direction of the nearest exit. These are not behaviors of deception, but rather actions that signal that a person feels uncomfortable. These forms of the age-old flight response are distancing nonverbal behaviors that tell you the business person is unhappy with what is occurring at the table. The fight response. The fight response is the limbic brain's final tactic for survival through aggression. When a person confronting danger cannot avoid detection by freezing and cannot save himself by distancing or escaping, flight, the only alternative left is to fight. In our evolution as a species, we, along with other mammals, developed the strategy of turning fear into rage in order to fight off attackers. In the modern world, however, acting on our rage may not be practical or even legal. So the limbic brain has developed other strategies beyond the more primitive physical fight response. One form of modern aggression is an argument. Although the original meaning of the term argument relates simply to a debate or discussion, the word is increasingly used to describe a verbal altercation. An overheated argument is essentially fighting by non-physical means. The use of insults, ad hominem phrases, counter-allegations, denigration of professional stature, goading, and sarcasm are all, in their own ways, the modern equivalents of fighting, because they are all forms of aggression. If you think about it, civil lawsuits can even be construed as a modern and socially sanctioned type of fight or aggression, in which litigants aggressively argue two opposing viewpoints. While humans probably engage in physical altercations far less now than in other periods in our history, fighting is still a part of our limbic armory. Although some people are more prone to violence than others, our limbic response shows up in many ways other than punching, kicking, and biting. You can be very aggressive without physical contact, for example, just by using your posture, your eyes, by puffing out your chest, or by violating another's personal space. Threats to our personal space elicit a limbic response on an individual level. Interestingly, these territorial violations can also create limbic responses on a collective level. When one country intrudes into the space of another, it often results in economic sanctions, severing of diplomatic relations, or even wars. Obviously, it is easy to recognize when someone uses the fight response to commit a physical assault. What I want to identify for you are the not-so-obvious ways in which individuals exhibit some of the more subtle behaviors associated with the fight response. Just as we have seen modified expressions of the freeze and flight limbic reactions, modern decorum dictates that we refrain from acting on our primitive inclinations to fight when threatened. In general, I advise people to refrain from using aggression, verbal or physical, as a means of achieving their objectives. Just as the fight response is the act of last resort in dealing with a threat, used only after the freeze and flight tactics have proven unworkable, so too should you avoid it whenever feasible. Aside from the obvious legal and physical reasons for this recommendation, aggressive tactics can lead to emotional turmoil, making it difficult to concentrate and think clearly about the threatening situation at hand. When we are emotionally aroused, and a good fight will do that, it affects our ability to think effectively. This happens because our cognitive abilities are hijacked, so that the limbic brain can have full use of all available cerebral resources. One of the best reasons for studying nonverbal behaviors is that they can sometimes warn you when a person intends to harm you physically, giving you time to avoid a potential conflict. Comfort, discomfort, and pacifiers. To borrow a phrase from the old Star Trek series, the prime directive of the limbic brain is to ensure our survival as a species. It does this by being programmed to make us secure by avoiding danger or discomfort, and seeking safety or comfort whenever possible. It also allows us to remember experiences from our past encounters and build upon them. Thus far, we have seen how efficiently the limbic system helps us to deal with threats. Now let's look at how our brain and body work together to comfort us and give us confidence in our personal safety. When we experience a sense of comfort, well-being, the limbic brain leaks this information in the form of body language congruent with our positive feelings. Observe someone resting in a hammock on a breezy day. His body reflects the high comfort being experienced by his brain. On the other hand, when we feel distressed, discomfort, the limbic brain expresses nonverbal behavior that mirrors our negative state of being. Just watch people at the airport when a flight is canceled or delayed. Their bodies say it all. Therefore, we want to learn to look more closely at the comfort and discomfort behaviors we see every day, and use them to assess for feelings, thoughts, and intentions. In general, when the limbic brain is in a state of comfort, this mental and physiological well-being is reflected in nonverbal displays of contentment and high confidence. When, however, the limbic brain is experiencing discomfort, the corresponding body language is characterized by behaviors emblematic of stress or low confidence. Knowledge of these behavioral markers, or tells, will help you determine what a person may be thinking, or how to act, or what to expect when dealing with other people in any social or work context. A brain that doesn't forget. The limbic brain is like a computer that receives and retains data from the outside world. In doing so, it compiles and maintains a record of negative events and experiences, a burned finger from a hot stove, an assault by a human or animal predator, or even hurtful comments, as well as pleasant encounters. Using this information, the limbic brain allows us to navigate a dangerous and often unforgiving world. For example, once the limbic system registers an animal as dangerous, that impression becomes embedded in our emotional memory, so that the next time we see that animal, we will react instantly. Likewise, if we run into the class bully 20 years later, negative feelings of long ago will percolate to the surface once more, thanks to the limbic brain. The reason it is often difficult to forget when someone has hurt us is because that experience registers in the more primitive limbic system, which is the part of the brain designed not to reason, but to react. I recently encountered an individual with whom I was never on the best of terms. It had been 4 years since I had last seen this person, yet my visceral limbic reactions were just as negative as they had been years ago. My brain was reminding me that this individual takes advantage of others, so it was warning me to stay away. This phenomenon is precisely what Gavin De Becker was talking about in his insightful book, The Gift of Fear. Conversely, the limbic system also works efficiently to register and retain a record of positive events and experiences, that is, satisfaction of basic needs, praise, and enjoyable interpersonal relationships. Thus, a friendly or familiar face will cause an immediate reaction, a sense of pleasure and well-being. The feelings of euphoria when we see an old friend or recognize a pleasant smell from childhood occur because those encounters have been registered in the comfort zone of the memory bank associated with our limbic system. The importance of pacifying behaviors. Understanding how the limbic system's freeze, flight, and fight responses influence nonverbal behavior is only part of the equation. As you study nonverbal behavior, you will discover that whenever there is a limbic response, especially to a negative or threatening experience, it will be followed by what I call pacifying behaviors. These actions, often referred to in the literature as adapters, serve to calm us down after we experience something unpleasant or downright nasty. In its attempt to restore itself to normal conditions, the brain enlists the body to provide comforting, pacifying behaviors. Since these are outward signals that can be read in real time, we can observe and decode them immediately and in context. Pacifying is not unique to our species. For example, cats and dogs lick themselves and each other to pacify. Humans engage in much more diverse pacification behaviors. Some are very obvious, while others are much more subtle. Most people would readily think of a child's thumb sucking when asked to identify a pacifying behavior, but do not realize that after we outgrow that comfort display, we adopt more discreet and socially acceptable ways to satisfy the need to calm ourselves, that is, chewing gum, biting pencils. Most people don't notice the more subtle pacifying behaviors, or are unaware of their significance in revealing a person's thoughts and feelings. That is unfortunate. To be successful at reading nonverbal behavior, learning to recognize and decode human pacifiers is absolutely critical. Why? Because pacifying behaviors reveal so much about a person's current state of mind, and they do so with uncanny accuracy. Captured in the neck of time. Neck touching and or stroking is one of the most significant and frequent pacifying behaviors we use in responding to stress. When women pacify using the neck, they often do so by covering or touching their suprasternal notch with their hand, as demonstrated in Figure 7 of the PDF. The suprasternal notch is the hollow area between the Adam's apple and the breastbone that is sometimes referred to as the neck dimple. When a woman touches this part of her neck and or covers it with her hand, it is typically because she feels distressed, threatened, uncomfortable, insecure, or fearful. This is a relatively significant behavioral clue that can be used to detect, among other things, the discomfort experienced when a person is lying or concealing important information. I once worked on an investigation where we thought an armed and dangerous fugitive might be hiding out at his mother's home. Another agent and I went to the woman's house, and when we knocked at the door, she agreed to let us in. We showed her our identification and began asking her a series of questions. When I inquired, "Is your son in the house?" she put her hand to her suprasternal notch and said, "No, he's not." I noted her behavior, and we continued with our questioning. After a few minutes, I asked, "Is it possible that while you were at work, your son could have sneaked into the house?" Once again, she put her hand up to her neck dimple and replied, "No, I'd know that." I was now confident that her son was in the house, because the only time she moved her hand to her neck was when I suggested that possibility. To make absolutely sure my assumption was correct, we continued to speak with the woman until, as we prepared to leave, I made one last inquiry. "Just so I can finalize my records, you're positive he's not in the house, right?" For a third time, her hand went to her neck as she affirmed her earlier answer. I was now certain the woman was lying. I asked for permission to search the house, and, sure enough, her son was hiding in a closet under some blankets. She was lucky she was not charged with obstruction of justice. Her discomfort in lying to the police about her fugitive son caused her limbic system to generate a pacifying behavior that tipped her hand and gave her away. I look for pacifying behaviors in people to tell me when they are not at ease or when they are reacting negatively to something I have done or said. In an interview situation, such a display might be in response to a specific question or comment. Behaviors that signal discomfort, that is, leaning away, a frown, and crossed or tense arms, are usually followed by the brain enlisting the hands to pacify. See Figure 8 of the PDF. I look for these behaviors to confirm what is going on in the mind of the person with whom I am dealing. As a specific example, if every time I ask a subject, "Do you know Mr. Hillman?" he responds, "No," but then immediately touches his neck or mouth, I know he is pacifying to that specific question, as seen in Figure 9. I don't know if he's lying, because deception is notoriously difficult to detect. But I do know that he is bothered by the inquiry, so much so that he has to pacify himself after he hears it. This will prompt me to probe further into this area of inquiry. Pacifying behaviors are important for an investigator to note, since sometimes they help uncover a lie or hidden information. I find pacifying indicators of greater significance and reliability than trying to establish veracity. They help to identify what specific subjects trouble or distress a person. Knowing these can often lead to evincing information previously hidden that might give us new insights. Types of pacifying behaviors. Pacifying behaviors take many forms. When stressed, we might soothe our necks with a gentle massage, stroke our faces, or play with our hair. This is done automatically. Our brains send out the message, "Please pacify me now." And our hands respond immediately, providing an action that will help make us comfortable again. Sometimes we pacify by rubbing our cheeks or our lips from the inside with our tongues. Or we exhale slowly with puffed cheeks to calm ourselves. See figures 10 and 11. If a stressed person is a smoker, he or she will smoke more. If the person chews gum, he or she will chew faster. All these pacifying behaviors satisfy the same requirement of the brain. That is, the brain requires the body to do something that will stimulate nerve endings, releasing calming endorphins in the brain, so that the brain can be soothed. For our purposes, any touching of the face, head, neck, shoulder, arm, hand, or leg in response to a negative stimulus, that is, a difficult question, an embarrassing situation, or stress as a result of something heard, seen, or thought, is a pacifying behavior. These stroking behaviors don't help us to solve problems. Rather, they help us to remain calm while we do. In other words, they soothe us. Men prefer to touch their faces. Women prefer to touch their necks, clothing, jewelry, arms, and hair. When it comes to pacifiers, people have personal favorites. Some choose to chew gum, smoke cigarettes, eat more food, lick their lips, rub their chins, stroke their faces, play with objects, pens, pencils, lipstick, or watches, pull their hair, or scratch their forearms. Sometimes pacification is even more subtle, like a person brushing the front of his shirt or adjusting his tie, as the man is doing in figure 12 on the PDF. He appears simply to be preening himself, but in reality, he is calming his nervousness by drawing his arm across his body and giving his hands something to do. These two are pacifying behaviors, ultimately governed by the limbic system and exhibited in response to stress. Following are some of the most common and pronounced pacifying behaviors. When you see them, stop and ask yourself, why is this person pacifying? The ability to link a pacifying behavior with the specific stressor that caused it can help you understand a person's thoughts, feelings, and intentions more accurately. Pacifying behaviors involving the neck. Neck touching and/or stroking is one of the most significant and frequent pacifying behaviors we use in responding to stress. One person may rub or massage the back of his neck with his fingers. Another may stroke the sides of his neck or just under the chin above the Adam's apple, tugging at the fleshy area of the neck. This area is rich with nerve endings that, when stroked, reduce blood pressure, lower the heart rate, and calm the individual down. See figures 13 and 14 of the PDF. Over the decades that I have studied nonverbal behaviors, I have observed that there are gender differences in the way men and women use the neck to pacify themselves. Typically, men are more robust in their pacifying behaviors, grasping or cupping their necks just beneath the chin with their hands, thereby stimulating the nerves, specifically the vagus nerves or the carotid sinus of the neck, which in turn slow the heart rate down and have a calming effect. Sometimes men will stroke the sides or the back of the neck with their fingers, or adjust their tie knot or shirt collar, demonstrated in Figure 15. Women pacify differently. For example, when women pacify using the neck, they will sometimes touch, twist, or otherwise manipulate a necklace if they are wearing one. As mentioned, the other major way women neck pacify is by covering their suprasternal notch with their hand. Women touch their hands to this part of their neck and or cover it when they feel stressed, insecure, threatened, fearful, uncomfortable, or anxious. Interestingly, when a woman is pregnant, I have observed that her hand will initially move toward her neck, but at the last moment will divert to her belly, as if to cover the fetus. The pacifying pendulum. Watch a couple as they converse at a table. If the woman begins to play with her necklace, most likely she is a little nervous. But if she transitions her fingers to her neck dimple, suprasternal notch, chances are there is an issue of concern to her, or she feels very insecure. In most instances, if she is using her right hand on her suprasternal notch, she will cup her right elbow with her left hand. When the stressful situation is over, or there is an intermission in the uncomfortable part of the discussion, her right hand will lower and relax across her folded left arm. If the situation again becomes tense, her right hand will rise once again to the suprasternal notch. From a distance, the arm movement looks like the needle on a stress meter, moving from resting on the arm to the neck, upright, and back again, according to the level of stress experienced. Pacifying behaviors involving the face. Touching or stroking the face is a frequent human pacifying response to stress. Motions such as rubbing the forehead, touching, rubbing, or licking the lip or lips, pulling or massaging the earlobe with thumb and forefinger, stroking the face or beard, and playing with the hair, all can serve to pacify an individual when confronting a stressful situation. As mentioned before, some individuals will pacify by puffing out their cheeks and then slowly exhaling. The plentiful supply of nerve endings in the face make it an ideal area of the body for the limbic brain to recruit to comfort itself. Pacifying behaviors involving sounds. Whistling can be a pacifying behavior. Some people whistle to calm themselves when they are walking in a strange area of a city or down a dark, deserted corridor or road. Some people even talk to themselves in an attempt to pacify during times of stress. I have a friend, as I am sure we all do, who can talk a mile a minute when nervous or upset. Some behaviors combine tactile and auditory pacification, such as the tapping of a pencil or the drumming of fingers. Excessive yawning. Sometimes we see individuals under stress yawning excessively. Yawning not only is a form of taking a deep breath, but during stress, as the mouth gets dry, a yawn could put pressure on the salivary glands. The stretch of various structures in and around the mouth causes the glands to release moisture into a dry mouth during times of anxiety. In these cases, it's not lack of sleep, but rather stress that causes the yawning. The leg cleanser. Leg cleansing is one pacification behavior that often goes unnoticed because it frequently occurs under a desk or table. In this calming or pacifying activity, a person places the hand or hands palm down on top of the leg or legs, and then slides them down the thighs toward the knee, as the woman in Figure 16 demonstrates. Some individuals will do the leg cleanser only once, but often it is done repeatedly, or the leg merely is massaged. It may also be done to dry off sweaty palms associated with anxiety, but principally, it is to get rid of tension. This nonverbal behavior is worth looking for, because it is a good indication that someone is under stress. One way to try and spot this behavior is to watch people who put one or both arms under the table. If they are doing leg cleansing, you will normally see the upper arm and shoulder moving in conjunction with the hand as it rubs along their leg. In my experience, I find the leg cleanser to be very significant because it occurs so quickly in reaction to a negative event. I have observed this action for years in cases when suspects are presented with damning evidence, such as pictures of a crime scene with which they are already familiar, guilty knowledge. This cleansing pacifying behavior accomplishes two things at once. It dries sweaty palms and pacifies through tactile stroking. You can also see it when a seated couple is bothered or interrupted by an unwelcome intruder, or when someone is struggling to remember a name. In police work, watch for the hand-leg pacifiers to appear when the interview session starts, and then note if they progressively increase when difficult questions arise. An increase in either the number or vigor of leg cleansers is a very good indicator that a question has caused some sort of discomfort for the person, either because he has guilty knowledge, he is lying, or because you are getting close to something he does not want to discuss. The behavior might also occur because the interviewee is distressed over what he is required to answer in response to our questions. So keep an eye on what goes on under the table by monitoring the movement of the arms. You will be surprised at how much you can glean from these behaviors. Heed this cautionary note about leg cleansing. While it is certainly seen in people who are being deceptive, I have also observed it in innocent individuals who are merely nervous. So be careful not to jump to any conclusions too quickly. The best way to interpret a leg cleanser is to recognize that it reflects the brain's need to pacify and, therefore, the reasons for the individual's behavior should be investigated further. From Facebook to Disgrace Book. During an interview for a job, an applicant was being questioned by his prospective employer. Everything was going well until, toward the end of the interview, the candidate began talking about networking and the importance of the Internet. The employer complimented him on this comment and made an offhand remark about how most college graduates used the Internet to network in a destructive way, using sites like Facebook to post messages and pictures that would prove to be an embarrassment later in the person's life. At that point, the employer noticed that the candidate did a vigorous leg cleansing with his right hand, wiping it along his thigh several times. The employer said nothing at the time, thanked the young man for the interview, and walked him out of the office. He then returned to his computer, his suspicion aroused by the candidate's pacifying behavior, and checked to see if the young man's profile was on Facebook. Sure enough, it was. And it was not flattering. The ventilator. This behavior involves a person, usually a male, putting his fingers between his shirt collar and neck and pulling the fabric away from his skin, as shown in Figure 17. This ventilating action is often a reaction to stress and is a good indicator that the person is unhappy with something he is thinking about or experiencing in his environment. A woman may perform this nonverbal activity more subtly by merely ventilating the front of her blouse or by tossing the back of her hair up in the air to ventilate her neck. The self-administered body hug. When facing stressful circumstances, some individuals will pacify by crossing their arms and rubbing their hands against their shoulders, as if experiencing a chill. Watching a person employ this pacifying behavior is reminiscent of the way a mother hugs a young child. It is a protective and calming action we adopt to pacify ourselves when we want to feel safe. However, if you see a person with his arms crossed in front, leaning forward, and giving you a defiant look, this is not a pacifying behavior. Using pacifiers to read people more effectively. In order to gain knowledge about a person through nonverbal pacifiers, there are a few guidelines you need to follow. 1. Recognize pacifying behaviors when they occur. I have provided you with all of the major pacifiers. As you make a concerted effort to spot these body signals, they will become increasingly easy to recognize in interactions with other people. 2. Establish a pacifying baseline for an individual. That way, you can note any increase and/or intensity in that person's pacifying behaviors and react accordingly. 3. When you see a person make a pacifying gesture, stop and ask yourself, what caused him to do that? You know the individual feels uneasy about something. Your job as a collector of nonverbal intelligence is to find out what that something is. 4. Understand that pacifying behaviors almost always are used to calm a person after a stressful event occurs. Thus, as a general principle, you can assume that if an individual is engaged in pacifying behavior, some stressful event or stimulus has preceded it and caused it to happen. 5. The ability to link a pacifying behavior with the specific stressor that caused it can help you better understand the person with whom you are interacting. 6. In certain circumstances, you can actually say or do something to see if it stresses an individual, as reflected in an increase in pacifying behaviors, to better understand his thoughts and intentions. 7. Note what part of the body a person pacifies. This is significant, because the higher the stress, the greater the amount of facial or neck stroking is involved. 8. Remember, the greater the stress or discomfort, the greater the likelihood of pacifying behaviors to follow. Pacifiers are a great way to assess for comfort and discomfort. In a sense, pacifying behaviors are supporting players in our limbic reactions. Yet they reveal much about our emotional state and how we are truly feeling. A final note on our limbic legacy. You are now in possession of information that is unknown to most people. You are aware that we have a very robust survival mechanism, freeze, flight, or fight, and possess a pacifying system to deal with stress. We are fortunate to have these mechanisms, not only for our own survival and success, but also to use in assessing the sentiments and thoughts of others. In this chapter, we also learned that, with the exception of certain reflexes, all behavior is governed by the brain. We have examined two of the three major brains within our cranial vault, the thinking neocortex brain and the more automatic limbic brain, and how they differ in terms of their roles. Both brains perform important functions. However, for our purposes, the limbic system is more important because it is the most honest brain, responsible for producing the most significant nonverbal signals for determining true thoughts and feelings. Now that you are familiar with the basics of how the brain reacts to the world, you might be wondering if detecting and decoding nonverbal behaviors is all that easy to do. This is a frequently asked question. The answer is yes and no. Once you've read this book, some nonverbal body cues will stand out. They literally scream for attention. On the other hand, there are many aspects of body language that are more subtle and, therefore, more difficult to spot. We will focus on both the more obvious and the more subtle behaviors that the limbic brain elicits from the body. In time and with practice, decoding them will become natural, like looking both ways before you cross a busy street. This brings us to our legs and feet, which propel us across the intersection and provide the focal point of our attention in the next chapter. 3. Getting a leg up on body language, nonverbals of the feet and legs. In the first chapter, I asked you to guess which is the most honest part of the body, the part that is most likely to reveal a person's true intentions and, thus, be a prime place to look for nonverbal signals that accurately reflect what he or she is thinking. It may surprise you, but the answer is the feet. That's right, your feet, along with your legs, win the Honesty Award hands, or should I say, feet, down. Now I will explain how to gauge the sentiments and intentions of others by focusing on their foot and leg actions. In addition, you will learn to look for telltale signs that help disclose what's going on under the table, even when you can't directly watch the lower limbs. First, however, I want to share with you why your feet are the most honest part of your body, so you'll gain a better appreciation for why the feet are such good gauges of people's true sentiments and intentions. An evolutionary footnote. For millions of years, the feet and legs have been the primary means of locomotion for the human species. They are the principal means by which we have maneuvered, escaped, and survived. Since the time our ancestors began to walk upright across the grasslands of Africa, the human foot has carried us quite literally around the world. Marvels of engineering, our feet allow us to feel, walk, turn, run, swivel, balance, kick, climb, play, grasp, and even write. And while not as efficient at certain tasks as our hands, we lack an opposable big toe. Nevertheless, as Leonardo da Vinci once commented, our feet and what they can perform are a testament to exquisite engineering. The writer and zoologist Desmond Morris observed that our feet communicate exactly what we think and feel, more honestly, than any other part of our bodies. Why are the feet and legs such accurate reflectors of our sentiments? For millions of years, long before humans spoke, our legs and feet reacted to environmental threats, that is, hot sand, meandering snakes, ill-tempered lions, instantaneously, without the need for conscious thought. Our limbic brains made sure that our feet and legs reacted as needed, by either ceasing motion, running away, or kicking at a potential threat. This survival regimen, retained from our ancestral heritage, has served us well, and continues to do so today. In fact, these age-old reactions are still so hardwired in us that when we are presented with something dangerous or even disagreeable, our feet and legs still react as they did in prehistoric times. First, they freeze. Then they attempt to distance. And finally, if no other alternative is available, they prepare to fight and kick. This freeze, flight, or fight mechanism requires no high-order cognitive processing. It is reactive. This important evolutionary development benefited the individual as well as the group. Humans survived by seeing and responding to the same threat simultaneously, or by reacting to the vigilant actions of others and behaving accordingly. When the group was threatened, whether or not they all saw the danger, they were able to react in synchrony by noting each other's movements. In our contemporary world, soldiers on patrol will fix their attention on the point man. When he freezes, they all freeze. When he lunges for the side of the road, they also take cover. When he charges an ambush, they react in kind. With regard to these life-saving group behaviors, little has changed in 5 million years. This ability to communicate non-verbally has assured our survival as a species. And even though today we often cover our legs with clothing and our feet with shoes, our lower limbs still react, not only to threats and stressors, but also to emotions, both negative and positive. Thus, our feet and legs transmit information about what we are sensing, thinking, and feeling. The dancing and jumping up and down we do today are extensions of the celebratory exuberance people exhibited millions of years ago, upon the completion of a successful hunt. Be they Maasai warriors jumping high in place or couples dancing up a storm, throughout the world, the feet and legs communicate happiness. We even stomp our feet in unison at ball games to let our team know we are rooting for them. Other evidence of these foot feelings abounds in our everyday life. For example, watch children and their foot movements for a real education in feet honesty. A child may be sitting down to eat, but if she wants to go out and play, notice how her feet sway, how they stretch to reach the floor from a high chair, even when the child is not yet finished with her meal. A parent may try to keep her in place, yet the girl's feet will inch away from the table. Her torso may be held by that loving parent, but the youngster will twist and squirm her legs and feet ever so diligently in the direction of the door. An accurate reflection of where she wants to go. This is an intention cue. As adults, we are, of course, more restrained in these limbic exhibitions, but just barely so. the most honest part of our body. When reading body language, most individuals start their observation at the top of a person, the face, and work their way down, despite the fact that the face is the one part of the body that most often is used to bluff and conceal true sentiments. My approach is the exact opposite. Having conducted thousands of interviews for the FBI, I learned to concentrate on the suspect's feet and legs first, moving upward in my observations until I read the face last. When it comes to honesty, truthfulness decreases as we move from the feet to the head. Unfortunately, law enforcement literature over the last 60 years, including some contemporary works, has emphasized a facial focus when conducting interviews or attempting to read people. Further complicating an honest read is the fact that most interviewers compound the problem by allowing the interviewees to conceal their feet and legs under tables and desks. When you give it some thought, there's good reason for the deceitful nature of our facial expressions. We lie with our faces because that's what we've been taught to do since early childhood. "Don't make that face," our parents growl when we honestly react to the food placed in front of us. "At least look happy when your cousins stop by," they instruct, and you learn to force a smile. Our parents and society are, in essence, telling us to hide, deceive, and lie with our faces for the sake of social harmony. So it is no surprise that we tend to get pretty good at it. So good, in fact, that when we put on a happy face at a family gathering, we might look as if we love our in-laws when, in reality, we are fantasizing about how to hasten their departure. Think about it. If we couldn't control our facial expressions, why would the term poker face have any meaning? We know how to put on a so-called party face, but few pay any attention to their own feet and legs, much less to those of others. Nervousness, stress, fear, anxiety, caution, boredom, restlessness, happiness, joy, hurt, shyness, coyness, humility, awkwardness, confidence, subservience, depression, lethargy, playfulness, sensuality, and anger can all manifest through the feet and legs. A meaningful touch of the legs between lovers. The shy feet of a young boy meeting strangers. The stance of the angry. The nervous pacing of an expectant father. All of these signal our emotional state and can be readily observed in real time. If you want to decode the world around you and interpret behavior accurately, watch the feet and the legs. They are truly remarkable and honest in the information they convey. The lower limbs must be viewed as a significant part of the entire body when collecting nonverbal intelligence. Significant nonverbal behaviors involving the feet and legs. Happy feet. Happy feet are feet and legs that wiggle and or bounce with joy. When people suddenly display happy feet, particularly if this occurs right after they have heard or seen something of significance, it's because it has affected them in a positive emotional way. Happy feet are a high confidence tell, a signal that a person feels he is getting what he wants or is in an advantageous position to gain something of value from another person or from something else in his environment. Lovers seeing each other after a long separation will get happy feet at their airport reunion. You don't need to look under the table to see happy feet. Just look at a person's shirt and or his shoulders. If his feet are wiggling or bouncing, his shirt and shoulders will be vibrating or moving up and down. These are not grossly exaggerated movements. In fact, they are relatively subtle. But if you watch for them, they are discernible. Try this little demonstration for yourself. Sit in a chair in front of a full-length mirror and begin wiggling or bouncing your feet. As you do, you'll start to see your shirt and or shoulders move. While with others, if you're not watching carefully above the table for these telltale signs of lower limb behaviors, you might miss them. But if you're willing to take the time and effort to look, you'll be able to detect them. The key to using happy feet as an effective nonverbal signal is first to note a person's foot behavior, and then to watch for any sudden changes that take place. Allow me to express two points of caution. First, as with all nonverbal behavior, happy feet must be taken in context to determine if they represent a true tell or just excess nervous behavior. For example, if a person has naturally jittery legs, a kind of restless leg syndrome, then it might be hard to distinguish happy feet from an individual's normal nervous energy. If the rate or intensity of jiggling increases, however, particularly right after a person hears or witnesses something of significance, I might view that as a potential signal that he or she now feels more confident and satisfied with the current state of affairs. Second, moving feet and legs may simply signify impatience. Our feet often jiggle or bounce when we grow impatient or feel the need to move things along. Watch a class full of students and notice how often their legs and feet will twitch, jiggle, move, and kick throughout the class. This activity usually increases as class draws to a close. More often than not, this is a good indicator of impatience and the need to speed things up, not a sign of happy feet. Such activity reaches a crescendo as dismissal time approaches in my classes. Perhaps the students are trying to tell me something. Happy feet mean life is sweet. A while back, I was watching a poker tournament on television, and I saw a guy dealt a flush, a powerful hand. Below the table, his feet were going wild. They were wiggling and bouncing like the feet of a child who's just learned he's going to Disney World. The player's face was stoic. His demeanor above the table was calm. But down near the floor, there was a whole lot of shaking going on. Meanwhile, I was pointing at the TV set and urging the other players to fold their hands and get out of the game. Too bad they couldn't hear me, because two players called his bets and lost their money to his unbeatable hand. This player has learned how to put on his best poker face. Obviously, however, he has a long way to go when it comes to putting on his best poker feet. Fortunately for him, his opponents, like most people, have spent a lifetime ignoring three-quarters of the human body, from the chest on down, paying no attention to the critical nonverbal tells that can be found there. Poker rooms aren't the only place where you see happy feet. I have seen them in plenty of meeting rooms and boardrooms, and just about everywhere else. While writing this chapter, I was at the airport and overheard a young mother sitting next to me as she was talking on her cell phone to members of her family. At first, her feet were flat on the ground, but when her son got on the phone, her feet began bouncing up and down effusively. I did not need her to tell me how she felt about her child or his priority in her life. Her feet shouted it to me. Remember, whether you are playing cards, doing business, or simply are engaged in a conversation with friends, happy feet are one of the most honest ways our brains truthfully exclaim, "I am elated." A sign of the feet. Julie, a human resource executive for a major corporation, told me she began noticing foot behaviors after attending one of my seminars for bank executives. She put her new knowledge to good use just a few days after returning to her job. "I was responsible for selecting company employees for overseas assignments," she explained. "When I asked one potential candidate if she wanted to work abroad, she responded with bouncing happy feet and an affirmative, yes. However, when I next mentioned that the destination was Mumbai, India, her feet stopped moving altogether. Noting the change in her nonverbal behavior, I asked why she didn't want to go there. The candidate was astounded. "Is it that noticeable? I didn't say anything. Did someone else say something to you?" she asked in a startled voice. I told the woman I could sense she wasn't pleased with the intended work location. "You're right," she admitted. "I thought I was being considered for Hong Kong, where I have a few friends." It was obvious she did not want to go to India, and her feet left no doubt about her feelings on the matter. When feet shift direction, particularly toward or away from a person or object, we tend to turn toward things we like or are agreeable to us, and that includes individuals with whom we are interacting.